Madonna with Material Girl back from the go-go 80s. And she's here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about the material world and materialism and indeed what people should be aware of and perhaps try to detach from in this material world. And we want to discuss namely with Catholic author Lorraine Bennett, who has a new book out from Sophia Institute Press, The Little Way of Living with Less, Learning to Let Go with the Little Flower. She has written about her inspiration from the French Catholic Saint Therese of Lisieux in the late 19th century. She discusses in this upcoming book about how important lessons of abstaining from the conspicuous consumption, the affluent world, and the spiritual and indeed material benefits from that for both individuals and society. Well, Lorraine, thank you for joining the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, starting now to discuss for our listeners, who is Therese of Lisieux, this French Catholic saint, and what attracted you to her?
Well, I'd always really been fond of her ever since I read The Story of a Soul, which she wrote, which is actually her autobiography. But she's a really fascinating saint. So she was born in 1873, and she died at age 24 of tuberculosis. And so she did not have a long life. She had only 5 years of formal education, and she entered the convent at Carmel at Lisieux at the age of 15. She was, like, at a very, very young age, she knew she wanted to enter the convent. And the thing that's fascinating just about her life and death, though she was so young, and even the nuns at the time, they were saying to the mother superior there, they said, what are you going to put in her obituary? I mean, all she did was she entered, she lived here 9 years, and then she died, you know, and they didn't even realize what a saint she was until that mother superior, she published, so she said for the obituary, essentially was her autobiography, which she had written, under obedience to the mother superior, and so they published that, and it instantly went viral back in the day. So we're talking, back in the late 1800s, it went viral. And people all over the world, like, all of a sudden knew about this little saint who had just died and apparently lived this inconspicuous little life. And letters started pouring into the Pope at the time saying, make her a saint, canonize her, and he was under such pressure that eventually she actually was canonized early, against, like, canon law, I think, which was requiring, at the time, I think they required, like, 50 years, of investigation or whatever after the death. But in any case, their miracles were happening, like, all over the world, and it was all attributed to Saint Therese, because when you read her autobiography, she actually promises that she will spend her heaven, as soon as she gets to heaven, she's going to start, working to save souls on earth. So that kind of was, that's a long answer, I don't know. Anyway, but that's kind of one of the fascinating things about her saint, about the saint. But of course, the story, her autobiography itself is amazing.
Well, that's an interesting story. I personally had not been that familiar with Therese of Lisieux. I, just heard about her briefly here and there mentioned. But it's interesting for our topic here. You're talking about a lifespan, born in 1873 and then died in 1897. This turn of the century. I mean, for many countries, it's referred to as the Gilded Age. I mean, here in the United States and also in Germany and other places like the United Kingdom, you had precisely this rise of industrial development and, mass industrial society, big corporations, leisure class. I mean, you have later in the United Kingdom under King Edward VII, you know, the Edwardians, as they're called, the decade and a half right before World War One, this sort of age of elegance. So it's, I guess it's, you know, it's an interesting contrast now that I think about it, of this person who as you indicated, wrote about it in her biography published after her death, you know, really lived this life of piety and again, poverty of the soul, you discuss in the book, precisely in sort of
exactly.
contrast to the world that's really becoming much more technocratic. And as you indicate in the book, you know, in France, in other places at this time, there was then in this sort of milieu, this spirit, there's kind of a growing attacks on sort of spirituality, on the church, and, you know, this rise of a, you know, Darwinian sort of totally materialistic world. So interesting contrast
right.
there.
She was aware of it, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yeah,
she's
perfect for this because she actually was aware of this, and she was fascinated actually by science and materialism, and she was not immune to that, and she was also raised in a very well-to-do middle-class family, and her mother was a lace maker, her father was a watchmaker, but they, you know, they lived a very nice life, and you know, so she was actually attracted to the worldliness, let's say, and she wrote about that and how she had to detach from it, but at a very young age, like, you know, she was wise beyond her years, so she was aware of the attraction of both materialism and the material goods and the beauty surrounding her in the world.
Well, interesting. And, you know, live with less you know, this role model of Thérèse of Lisieux. How did this come to you in your life? Or what sort of brought this on, your interesting analysis here, your dedication to this topic?
Yeah, well, actually, the immediate sort of impetus for me in writing this whole book was that, for over 20 years, my husband and I, we had raised our family in one of those typical suburban McMansions, far, far away from work, you know, in fact, an hour and a half drive each way in Northern Virginia for my husband and me. I mean, he did it 5 days a week, but I did it like I was working part-time, and so I was also driving. And one day, a few years ago, our kids had grown up and left the home, and we were empty nesters. And my husband says to me, he goes, you know, Lorraine, we only live in 10% of this house. And yet we're spending a lot of time and money, an inordinate amount of time and money, you know, cleaning it and fixing the roof and repairing the leaks and all these things that happen with a big house. And he said, you know, it's really only a 4,000 square foot storage unit for our kids' stuff and the stuff they don't actually want. And so we decided to like really to make this drastic change. And so we sell the house, and we sold all the furniture or donated it. And the kids didn't even want, like, we had boxes of trophies in the basement from when they were kids, you know, and they didn't even want this stuff. They said, throw it away. And so we downsized, and I was thinking about that. It was really quite a torturous project, actually, for me. So, you know, that's when I turned to St. Thérèse and her little way. And because I was thinking about the whole, you know, the popular trends of minimalism and decluttering and small living and all that stuff. But I was wondering, what are the deeper spiritual realities underlying this? And it's, you know, it's wonderful to say, oh, declutter your room, you know, declutter, take 15 minutes a day or whatever, you know, but when you're doing something drastic like this, like really getting rid of almost everything, I wanted to start looking at I needed some spiritual guidance. And that's when I turned to St. Thérèse, and she's all about detachment and trust and simplicity and poverty of spirit. And so I wanted to write about all these virtues and hopefully gain some understanding for myself as well. and others.
Yeah,
whoever.
Oh yes, indeed. Go ahead.
No, no, no. That's okay. I was going to say people have said to me, you know, gosh, I'd like to do that too, but I don't know where to start. And a lot of people are kind of flummoxed by the whole idea. And so I wanted to write about it for them too, you know, for the people who are wondering, like, what is going on here and what can I do to make this process a little smoother? But also it's not just for those people who are downsizing drastically like we did, but it's also just for anybody who wants to kind of live with a little bit less and not to be burdened by all these material things that are really dragging us down.
Yeah, and indeed, in the book, you have some interesting stories about this house, this sort of McMansion, that, you know, you had some real disasters of, like, sewage problems just failing on you, and you had to, you know, have the yard and so forth dug up. So interesting stories there. Well, you know, you write in the book that people are embodied souls. They're incarnational beings capable of transcendence. And so seeking what is above, nonetheless, we dwell here on God's earth, and so our home is both here and not here. What is the proper role of material goods in a person's life? I mean, I think, for example, I've read in the past that some scholars have noted that, you know, the Bible is actually the most materialistic of scriptures among the world's religions, that it always has this consistent focus on human well-being, you know, land of milk and honey, and, you know, healing miracles of Jesus and so forth. So how should people look at material goods, and what's the proper role of such material benefits in a person's life?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a really great point that you're making about the Bible as well. And I think, I mean, you're really capturing it, because God himself decided to become a human being. That's what's amazing, is that he becomes incarnate in Jesus Christ, and he takes on a physical body and endures all the suffering that humans can endure. And yet he also experienced he enjoyed having dinners with his friends, and he loved his friends, and he healed by touching people. And so we're not like disembodied spirits. I know there's a heresy. I always get my heresies mixed up, but there's a heresy where, you know, you think you're just like just a soul, you know, and the body is evil, you know. I wonder, was that Jansenism? I'm not sure, because Therese was fighting against Jansenism in her day and age. But anyway, so we're not, we appreciate and we love and we appreciate all the beautiful things, the material things that God has given us. But we have to keep them in the proper order. And I think that's the mistake that we so easily make with material things, is that they just start creeping into becoming the number one attachment that we have, instead of us being attached to God alone, and using the material things in the proper way. But we just so easily slip into the things using us. You know, there's that saying that possessions quickly start to possess us if we're not careful. So we have to keep our eye on it at all times.
Yeah, and you note in the book that Psalm 95 from the Bible in the Catholic Church is prayed for the invitatoria in the liturgy of the hours on a regular basis. And that reminds people of, you know, the Israelites in their exodus from Egypt. And, you know, of course, the Bible recounts in the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, that, you know, the Israelites, they, even though they'd been rescued from, you know, slavery, that, you know, they started to sort of yearn for going back to the flesh pots of Egypt. And, you know, even though God was showing them miracles and he continued to show them miracles, and they were, you know, receiving manna from heaven, they're being fed, and yet they still grumbled and complained. Why did they complain, do you think? And what lesson does this hold for people today?
Yeah. I know. I so relate to those Israelites, actually. And I think that's the thing, is we're kind of, each of us, enacting kind of this drama of salvation in our own lives. And sometimes we just don't always realize it or think about it. But yeah, the Israelites, here they are, rescued from slavery, and God, excuse me, God did so many amazing things, showing them, you know, like the way he parted the Red Sea, you know, so that they could go right through, and then he, you know, all the Egyptian chariots and charioteers, and they're all drowned, you know, behind them. They see this, and they see they're following God in the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of night by, you know, pillar of fire by night. And then when they're hungry, he feeds them in the desert. He gives them everything they need. They had food. They're not like starving. So, you know, what is their problem? And they just want, they're like, oh, I just miss, you know, I miss being a slave in Egypt. And we're like, why would they miss that? But it's exactly, I find it in my own life as well. Like they're on two levels, like one on the kind of the superficial level, which I actually describe in the book where we left our home in, when we were a really young family, we left our home in California and we sold everything and we went to Germany. But the interesting thing is, you know, how we yearned for California. And it's like, why was I yearning for California? But anyway, so there's that just kind of very human thing of wanting to be in a comfortable place that you know, and just wanting to stay where you are and just settle in and not leave and not change. We just have these, I think it's a human condition. But there, on the spiritual level as well, we all probably know that experience of being attached to our own sins, you know, it, in a strange way. Like, why do I go to confession and say the same things over and over? You know, it's like, why am I not immediately a saint? Or, you know, after I've been forgiven, I go to confession, I'm forgiven, and I, you know, here I am, perfect. And for a moment, no, not perfect, but you know what I mean. It's like, why would I go back? Why do I fall back into sin? So I think everybody experiences this drama of salvation on the obvious level, the literal level, and then the spiritual level as well.
Well, you know, thinking about material blessings, I guess that raises a question, at least that came to me in reading your book. You know, do wealthy people often dismiss God's existence? And that seems rather strange that if such wealthy people have received so many blessings of God, yet your writing seems to indicate that, you know, it's often precisely wealthy people who just sort of ignore their dependence on God and what they've received.
Yeah, well, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, there's so many wealthy people who are very generous as well. My husband was, for example, my husband used to be, before he retired, he was the CEO or president of Catholic Charities in the Diocese of Arlington. And they would raise so much money for beautiful ministries in the church. So, for example, they started a free clinic for immigrants, and they started a food program where they could truck. They had actual trucks that would have, you know, refrigeration, and that you could bring healthy food out into some remote areas that were suffering, especially like during the pandemic when a lot of people were really suffering. And so there's many, many wealthy people who are very, very generous, and I want to absolutely make that clear. But I think the tendency, like the attraction of wealth, is just so strong that there are also many wealthy people who are just consumed by it. And I think that also in our whole first world, you know, country, we get too obsessed with material things, and it's actually making us unhappy. That's what I think is, like, we can see the result by the fact that we are much less happy in the middle of all our material wealth. And yes, there are, you know, there's that passage from the Bible of, you know, it's more difficult for a rich man to enter how does that go? Enter, I'm not good with scripture because I'm Catholic. Enter heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle. So Christ says that, but he's trying to show us not that all wealthy people are going to not able to, but simply that it is difficult. So it's kind of a you know, an invitation to those who have great wealth to be very careful not to be overly attached to it and to be very generous with what they have because they've been given this incredible gift from God of their wealth. And it is due to God. That's what we have to remember. That's what St. Therese reminds us about every little thing, that it's all a gift from God.
Well, and you speak also, on the other hand, in dealing with wealth, you know, perhaps in the way people should deal with loss. You know, sometimes you talk about me, you know, maybe if a favorite mug is accidentally broken or a sweater is shrunk in the wash, that people should react with calm and peaceful acceptance. Well, you know, that maybe this will bring you then closer to God. Well, how has loss then affected your life? I mean, what sort of incidents have you faced?
In terms of loss, well, I don't know if you got to the part in the book, well, that was like quite a dramatic experience that we had in our family, but we were visiting our daughter and son-in-law and their two babies in Charlottesville, actually. He was there for he was at the University of Virginia, the Darden School of Business. And we were just visiting, and we were at the hotel, and we got a call. We got numerous texts first. And the text said, it was from an unknown number, and it said, "This is Lucy." That was my daughter. That's my daughter. "This is Lucy. Our house just burned down. We got out safely." And at first I thought it was a prank, you know, then they're going to ask me for $1,000 and send it to this place in Nigeria, right? You know, like I literally did not believe it, and I did not answer. And then we started getting calls over and over. Like I finally answered one of them. They said, "Look, Lucy's house did burn down." It was like they escaped with their lives. And that was it. Like literally nothing is left. And it was so, it's such a dramatic and shocking experience that you realize what really matters in your life. And what really matters is that they were alive. And I mean, they just barely escaped because it was one of those things that like accelerated, you know, it was just went up in, you know, minutes. And they literally just grabbed the sleeping toddler and the baby and ran out of the house. And that was it, you know. So we were faced with what is important in our lives. And there are thank goodness they survived. So that's an example of loss. I would say that was pretty dramatic, but, you know, reminds us of what is truly important.
Well, and among the various places you've lived and been to, I find interesting the contrast. I mean, having myself lived off and on for several years in Germany and in Austria. You talk about your own experience. You as well lived in Germany. Just discuss those differences between Germany, Europe, and the United States in terms of, you know, sort of urban planning and life there and lifestyle. And what can Americans learn from Europe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was something for us. I mean, just, you know, here we are coming from California. And we were, you know, relatively young. We had this young family. And we arrived there in Germany. We had no idea what about the differences in culture. I don't know why we didn't, but, you know, we were clueless Californians, I guess, at the time. And also, when you live in California for an extended period of time, you just start thinking that California is the place to be. It's like the perfect weather. It's right. There's the ocean. It's wonderful. You know, why would anybody go anywhere else? You know? And anyway, so we had this mindset and we landed Germany and then we are quickly learning that they do not think the same way that we do. They don't, their customs are different. The daily practices are very different. The rules, they have rules. You know, California, there's no rules, right? We were just so taken aback. We were really kind of caught off kilter. And some examples, I was constantly making mistakes. I would be like called out by the German grandmothers or the German neighbors. I would, like, for example, I hung my laundry out one time on a Sunday. Oh, you can't do that. It's Sunday. You're not allowed. Take that laundry down. And another thing was we let our kids ride their, when they were able to ride, you know, because we got there, we had a baby who was 6 months old and a three-year-old. But anyway, we let them ride their plastic big wheels down the street. And the Germans are horrified. They're like, this is so noisy. And plus, we did it during the quiet time. We weren't supposed to be making noises. There's a quiet time. And I have so many examples. Another example of our kids, we lived in two places in Germany. One was Stuttgart, and the other was Heidelberg, just outside of Heidelberg. And and we had our neighbors, where our kids made friends with the neighbor kids in Heidelberg, and they were also not German. They were from Taiwan. And so the kids would run through the bushes back and forth, you know, in the backyard. And one day our landlord came to me, and he goes, Lorraine, you got to stop your kids from running through the bushes. And I was like, how does he know? I'm like, how do you know they were running through the bushes? And he goes, well, and he leans down, and he picks up this one tiny, tiny berry, and he holds it up and shows it to me, and he goes, do you see this berry? It does not simply fall off a bush. It has to be knocked off. Therefore, your kids have been running through the bushes. And I'm like, okay, you're right. They were. He was like a detective. You know, they had such attention to detail. And then we learned to appreciate. Like, at first, we're taken aback. Like, we were so shocked by the differences between us Americans and the Germans. But yet, we grew in appreciation for their incredible attention to detail, beautiful attention to detail. I mean, that's why their trains run on time, you know, and they have great cars. But, you know, the attention to detail, their care about very small things, the beautiful, ways they would celebrate Catholic traditions that some of them we didn't even know about. And also, like, their appreciation for family time, so that they close their shops at 5. They close them during the afternoon hours so their families could have lunch. They close them on Sunday so that families could be together and take walks in the woods. They would enjoy nature. So we really grew to appreciate the differences.
Well, I found that interesting. I guess I've lived in cities like Vienna or Berlin. I guess I can't recall ever being told, I never hung out wash, but I've never heard before that, you know, like they would say, don't hang out wash on Sundays. Even that's new to me, or having even a specific quiet time in a village on the streets for like driving or something. That is something. I mean, I know of the other things that, you know, the shop hours being much more restricted. It's not, you know, like, you know, the big box open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week or such. And on Sundays and weekends as well. So, but that's interesting. Brings up issues. People are discussing maybe bringing back, say, blue laws here in the United States and having more of a quiet time, in the, on Sundays, and you mentioned also that, you know, people walk and bike a lot more. I mean, does that how would Americans try to incorporate such things here with, say, like public transportation or regulation of business?
Yeah, well, actually, so I should probably point out that this was, you know, about 30 years ago. So I don't know, maybe it could have changed in terms of the, you know, how carefully they attended to the details, but also we were living in, where I got in trouble with the laundry was we were living in a very small town in the first place, like outside of Stuttgart. So maybe they were a little bit more attentive to detail even than you might have noticed. But, but I do think it's like with them, it's kind of like it was so customary. And I think it would be hard to institute anything like to try to recreate that here in the U.S. It seems like we've already opened up the Pandora box. We expect to be able to go shopping whenever we want and, you know, 24/7 and that sort of thing, and to be noisy if we want to be noisy and so on and so forth. But it is a lovely lifestyle, and I think people are gradually appreciating a little bit more that idea that they want to have a place that is, you know, walkable or, it seems like I've been hearing about it a lot lately that that maybe we were a little too hasty when we built all these, you know, these suburbs and the roads going, you know, every which way. But then again, they're just like here in Northern Virginia, they're constantly expanding 66. So we were just noticing that the other day. We were driving out west on 66, and we realized, like, wow, it's not just going to be 2 4-lanes or six. I mean, I don't know. I think it's going to be 6 or 8 or something. I don't know what it is, but they've put these giant walls, like, right up against. It's practically in somebody's backyard. Like, so these people have bought, like, their big, big, big McMansions, you know, and they were probably at a distance when they bought from 66, you know, and they had plenty of green space in between. And now 66 is just like, well, we're taking over your land. So they're practically in their backyard going up that close, so they have to build these walls that are soundproofing walls, you know, and now these giant walls are lining 66. I mean, it's kind of amazing to me, because it wasn't like that when we first got here, I don't think. Yeah. So I don't know if you can reenact this.
Yeah, Interstate 66 outside of Washington, D.C., yeah, I've driven that recently as well. And that is indeed really expanding on both sides. It's something like, in various areas in the D.C. area, it's something like 6 lanes on each side. So it's it's with express lanes and so forth, and you know, all sorts of new overpasses and so forth that are just being recently constructed.
It's like L.A. turning into Los Angeles.
Yeah, that would be the analogy. Yeah, someone like you coming from California, you know, you would say, yeah, this is like L.A. now. And, you know, California, of course, is thought of as historically as, you know, the land for the car. You know, but you talk in the book that the average home size in 1950 was less than 1,000 square feet, and today the average is more than 6,000 square feet. And again, thinking of Europe, you know, according to many statistics, indeed, like home space, Americans are actually wealthier than Europeans, than Germans or French even. I mean, we do indeed have, on average, more home space or, you know, greater car ownership or such. But do these statistics measuring material wealth in the United States versus Europe, do they miss something? I mean, are Americans happier than Europeans?
Yeah, I don't think they are, especially – I mean, I don't – I think overall, like, the really – the wealthier the country, the less happy it seems like we are getting. But for sure, especially with this the whole COVID thing, but I don't know how it all – like, it, how they actually analyze these things. But I certainly believe that we – have our happiness is like has taken a downturn, especially when you read about like the increase in suicides, you know, that is going up. And that, again, that could be due to, that's multi-factor, you know, that's probably COVID and lockdowns and who knows what all, and drug use. But it could also, a part could be played by too much wealth and too much time on your hands, and also like the isolation that people experience, not just during lockdowns, but that isolation that some people experience in the suburbs themselves, because they were, the whole way they decided to redesign the way we live in America after the war. So before the war, we were kind of like Europe in a way, you know, with little small, you know, little towns and centered around, you know, kind of organically grew up around whatever, a church or a, you know, however they started. And, well, in Germany, they're still that way. But in the U.S. after the war, we decided to, you know, they had this big freeway project and they started, you know, building suburbs and zoning, and the whole zoning thing resulted in, you know, you live in this one place and then a separate place is where you can go shopping, and another separate place is where you can go to school, and another place is, you know, for church and everything you have to drive to. So, you know, so then like the end result is kind of like people isolated in their McMansions, you know, and they have everything that they need right there, but then they're just sitting alone and kids aren't going out like they used to in the old days. Like, you know, like we can remember just, you know, kids would run out, you know, we would go out and run down the street and go, you know, play, go to the park by ourselves and meet up with friends. My husband used to go play, you know, baseball. He would just run down the street and go find a baseball field and play with his friends. And, like, nowadays everything is so spread out, kids can't even do that. You know, they're kind of stuck at home, and then they just end up being stuck at home and playing their video games, you know, which leads to more isolation, more depression, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, you discussed talking about these sort of suburban subdivisions. You mentioned one neighborhood you lived in that you experienced that you would try to sort of invite, sort of stimulate neighborhood events with like a 4th of July, renting a snow cone maker for the neighborhood, and, you know, trying to invite people to come out and with grills and, you know, have a potluck meeting. You know, but, you know, these things didn't really catch on. But on the other hand, you now talk about this neighborhood of Farlington in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C., that it's older construction. It's more of like you talk about this European village-like construction where everything's sort of walkable, bikeable, and, you know, everything's close by and people really interact. Does architecture, you know, urban planning really make a difference on how people interact with each other, or are there other differences here as well? I mean, were there differences in, like, the people who lived in these neighborhoods, or is that really this urban planning, how you build, really affect how people live?
Wow, yeah. You know, that's a great question. And it's probably one of those, it's almost like it's a chicken and egg thing, maybe. I don't know. But it's interesting because one of the books I quoted in my book was this book by Christopher Alexander. And it was introduced to me by an architect, actually, who a friend, so let's see, my daughter's brother and sister-in-law. Anyway, so this is an architect, a young architect who is really studying this exact thing, urban planning, and can we bring back that feeling, whatever it was that we had back in Europe, or that is more livable, more hospitable, more humane, more conducive to that kind of life that we really need as human beings, that where we have interaction with our neighbors, where we feel like we're part of a community and not just stuck in a house in the middle of, you know, a suburb, a nameless, you know, suburb somewhere far away from church and school. But, you know, can that come back? And he's actually, you know, working on it. I don't know how big the movement is. It's like the new urban planners or something, and they're trying to, you know, see what they could do to going forward so that we're not just recreating our mistakes, you know, that we've done in the past, but we are actually trying to plan something new. And an interesting point, just another one, is that he talks about a lot of people talk about, but the whole problem of isolating the elderly as well. Like you just, that's another isolating factor. They go to live in these like assisted living, or first it starts out, it's a retirement community, right? And we saw so many people leaving, like where we live way out anyway, in our suburb, which is so after we went to Germany, we came back to the U.S. and we're like, yay, we can build a giant house in the suburbs. You know, we can have a house in the suburbs, but we not kind of losing the lessons that we had learned. But anyway, so we're out there, and what do they have? They have a giant retirement community near where we live. And so all these people, they sold their little houses, like, in Fairlington, like where I live now, and then they move out to this retirement community because they want to be with other retired people. And there's no kids that are allowed. You can't, it's 55 and older. You can't have kids living with you. And I'm like, what's the purpose of this? Well, and then what do? They build right across the street from that. They build an assisted living home. And right next to the assisted living is the nursing home, the evil dreaded nursing home. And some of these are bad. They are very, very bad. So I can say from personal experience, it's all isolation. You know, why can't we live together in a community? Well, like we do right now. There's young people. There's people with babies. There's singles. There's elderly. We've got it all right here, and we can walk to church. And when you're old, it's easier to walk than it is to drive a car. So, you know.
One thing that I guess you're writing about comparing these different neighborhoods in America and Europe is, you know, brings up other issues. I think about, you know, speaking of interstates and the car, what are differences between Europe and America in terms of car usage? I mean, you talked about the book that you only needed one car when you were living in Europe and Germany because you didn't use it that much. And, you know, maybe perhaps that raises a question of, you know, how many Europeans compared to Americans own cars, or how many? And also, I guess one issue not directly touched upon by you is, you know, what do you think about issues involving like mass transit, like commuter rail or, you know, subways and so forth? I mean, thinking of Germany again or Europe, I mean, there you really can live without a car. I mean, you have, you know, just mass transit everywhere. You can basically go anywhere without a car. There's just always rail lines or at least the bus to get you to someplace.
Right.
So it's, you know, that would be something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing in Europe. I mean, they're so efficient. The trains, the buses, the metros, everything is so well done. But I don't know if we can, I mean, it's in some places we have, you know, like we do have something here in D.C. and, of course, New York City. But, like, places that have already grown up around the whole freeway model, like, you know, L.A. and whatnot, like, it's probably really difficult to build. I can't imagine, like, just here building they were trying to add on an additional location. So the Silver Line was the metro that went out to Reston. So it went from, but just doing that, it was probably just billions and billions and billions of, and years and years and years and of construction. And I don't think we could recreate the European model here now, but I don't know. I mean, maybe in places they're trying it. It's so nice to be able to not have to have a car. And it's great for the environment. So, you know, it's win-win. And in Germany, it was just so easy to, like, my husband did use the car to get to work. And, of course, they drive. They have cars. And they have Autobahns, you know, the Autobahn, where you could drive as fast as you wanted. You know? It was like we didn't have there was no speed limit. I remember being terrified. And if you were driving along the Autobahn at a, you know, sedate rate of, like, let's say 70 miles per hour or something, 75, you would see a German car would come up behind you and they'd flash their lights. That's how they told you that you were going too slow. And they'd flash the lights and they would say, that meant get over or go faster. And they would just zip along 100 miles an hour. But, so they definitely have their cars in their freeways, but they somehow didn't have that interfere with the town. They didn't like take any of your living space away, and they didn't chop down the forest to do it, which we probably would have done here. We just, like, you know, who cares about the trees? We're going to chop them down. I've seen that happen with the, you know, with many a subdivision that went up. They would buy a, as we moved, you know, when we came from Germany, we moved out west, which everybody did in Virginia. Like, in order to find an affordable place, you go the far. You just keep going, driving west, and there was beautiful farmland, and there would be this beautiful farmland. And over the years, then it disappeared. It was bought by a housing developer, and what's the first thing they do? They came and just, you know, mowed those trees down. They just chopped them all down and put up as many houses as possible because of the profit motive. That's what they wanted, to make as much money as possible. So they get as big a house as you possibly can on as small a lot as you can. Then you have a ton of houses, no trees, and you can make a lot of money. I mean, that's what it looks like to me, but I don't know.
And I guess I'm a little bit thinking also as well of just consumer goods. You talk in the book of America sort of becoming a throwaway of society. Like, you know, you can, you talk about your mom had a darning needle and she would, you know, pair holes in socks and so forth. Whereas, you know, now you think, you know, people can just go to this, you know, big box store or whatever, department store, and get a bag full of brand new socks. What can be done or should be done to reverse any such trends in America towards becoming this kind of throwaway society?
Yeah, well, actually that is one of the themes of the book. And I would say purchase the little way of living with less, learning to let go with a little flower from sophiainstitute.com. And because that's what I'm talking about in the book a lot is we need to value the things that we have. And if we don't value them, then we should donate them to somebody who doesn't have these things, might need them, or, you know, that's the sort of thing, like, we keep just accumulating. We're becoming a little bit like hoarders in a way. Or we just throw things away and buy another, and then we're filling up the landfill. So either way, we're in a sense, now that I'm thinking about it, it's almost like we both overvalue and undervalue our material things, because we overvalue them in the sense that we just keep wanting to keep them and have them and get more, and we undervalue them in the sense that then when we're tired of them, we just throw them away and toss them in the landfill, which then, you know. And that's another thing that I love about where I live now. We have a once a month, on the first Saturday of the month, there's a what they call Big Garbage Day, and people are allowed to put out outside the in a central location anything you don't want. And what's happened is that everybody knows about this in the surrounding communities, and people drive by with trucks on Friday night. So first Saturday comes the big garbage. People drive by Friday night and everything will be gone. Like, they look through it and they say, I can fix this. It, you know, it's a broken table. Nope, I can fix it. I'm taking it. It doesn't go to the dump. And it's actually like a marvelous thing. I love how we're recycling in our when we're saving the landfills from getting overly filled up. But anyway, okay, I got a little sidetracked there. We both overvalue and undervalue. Yes, and so in my book I talk about, you know, the whole Marie Kondo thing of the sparking joy. our possessions, the things that we have and use daily, should be those things that really mean something to us. They spark joy for us. And that way you kind of limit the things you have to the ones that are really, truly important, and you're not just constantly accumulating more and more and more.
Well, in terms of these lessons, how do you one question that arises for me, how would you impart these things to kids? I mean, if you want, you know, raising the next generation to think differently about material wealth, what sort of things would you do in raising a family to raise kids up this way?
Well, that's a great question. And first of all, I think that my generation, our kids who are adult kids right now, and they're just starting out with their young families, I think they already have a sense of this. They are already less likely to be, I don't want to say hoarders, but they are less attracted to this way of living than I think I and my husband and I were. And perhaps they discovered it because they had such an abundance of stuff. Like the trophy thing. So our kids are grown up. They move out of the house. We've got all this stuff. We've got all their kid things. Like, we've saved everything from their childhood, right? All these trophies. And we ask them, so we're clearing out the basement, do you want this? And they go, no, none of them. Not one wanted a thing. How about the MVP? How about that one? Nope, don't want it. it's like they the younger generation already is smarter than we were, I think, in this regard. And so I think when they're raising their kids, they're like our daughter-in-law and son, they have four young kids. And they were just now asking them to go through their things. They have lots of toys. Kids always have toys, but they they ask them regularly, kind of like, can we get rid of some of the, like, are, what are you not playing with? Would you like to donate this? Would you like to give it to somebody else who maybe doesn't have as many toys as you do? So they're asking them that, And they also rotated. Another friend of my daughter's she would take things out of circulation, like if take some of the toys, like they were getting too many toys piling up. Take some of the toys, put them away in a closet. 3 months later, 4 months later, whatever, she would bring them out, and the kids would be like, oh, wow, look at that. This is awesome. And they didn't even remember that. Those were their toys, They'd forgotten all about it. And so now they have new toys. So they're not constantly buying things. So I think that they are, they're on the right track. They're on the right track, and they're helping their kids learn to be a little bit less consumer-oriented.
One interesting comment you made here, perhaps it's sort of more of a tangent. You talk about shopping, and the consumer culture. And one of the things that you sort of noted is that you were worried that when you went to a store, it seemed like everything you bought was made in China, and you're really disturbed by that, with all the political implications, and you wanted to try to sort of boycott China, not contribute to this, this dangerous repressive regime. But you found that to be really hard to do. What are sort of the political implications of what you're advocating here with living with less, or sort of international implications?
Wow. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, because. Yeah, we started out. I remember too. It was like my friends too. We all wanted to. We're like, okay, we're gonna boycott. We're gonna boycott everything, made in China. And it was that we couldn't find anything. It was like, okay, we're gonna buy made in America. And we can. We actually have. We've been trying to do some of that, made in America. But it's still hard because we're not doing manufacturing anymore here in our country, right? Like there's some, but. It's much less than it used to be. For example, like we were just talking to, I was talking to a friend of ours who's in the printing business, and there was all those supply chain issues, right, with for publishers, they couldn't get, you know, they couldn't get books printed and things printed or whatever. And it was, I asked him about it. I said, well, what is really the problem? Was it, you know, was it the trucks? Was it the, you know, is it that there's nobody driving trucks? Because there's various reasons, and I just was curious. And he goes, well, we're no longer, we used to print paper in this country. And then it became so cheap to do it in China that every single person, all the paper companies closed down. And it was, everybody was getting their printing done in China. So I'm like, even that, you know, it's just, I didn't even realize that's what was happening. And so we've shut down our own manufacturing, I think, and gone to China. And I don't know that what the solution is there to that. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, maybe you have a thought on it, but I don't know. I do like buying things made in Germany, though, like just as an aside. Germans make things so well. They really do. And we would, and when you find like some, now that I'm buying toys for the grandkids, I'll buy these like beautifully made, like little animals that they made in, they make in Germany, little tiny, you know, little various farm animals or animal, any kind. Or they make little wooden, you know, alphabets and things, even beautiful wooden toys, wooden things. So I guess Germany still has things like that. But it seems like in America, we, I don't know if we have that manufacturing, or if we do, I guess we do, but we probably outsource it to China.
Yeah, well, certainly for, you know, consumer goods, clothing and so forth, that has, you know, been outsourced. I mean, American manufacturing is all, you know, more like industrial goods. So, yeah, if you go down to your Walmart or something, you're probably not going to find a whole lot made in America. Well, I guess one closing thought, maybe going back to Trees of Luzu, you know, you talk about, you know, this person, you know, not a whole lot of education or such, and, you know, rather ordinary in background, and yet, you know, she wrote about how she was able to become holy by relying precisely on Christ. I mean, she herself noted that, you know, she had to rely upon God in order to be lifted up to heaven with her idea of the elevator. I mean, can anyone
right.
become a saint like Thérèse of Lisieux, or if we work at it, is that something that we can all do?
Well, I think that was one of the main messages that she brought about, that even an ordinary, very, very humble person who basically didn't do anything could become a saint. And that was her whole motivation. Was she said at one point, she said, I want to be everything. I want to be a warrior, a doctor, a priest, a martyr. I want to do all these great things for God. I want to be a saint, but I'm this small, tiny, hopeless person that really doesn't have anything, any talent or whatever. Actually, she was a great writer, it turns out. But, you know, so she's saying, yes, we all can. We all, if we just rely on God. And God inspired her to have those great dreams. And if God inspires you, then he will give you the grace to do that. And in fact, we're all called to holiness. So really, we're all called. What it is, you know, we say, well, I don't want to be a saint or something. But yes, what that means ultimately is that we're called to be one with Christ in heaven. That is our true home. That's like we're just journeying on this earth, and ultimately we do want to go to heaven. We want to be with God, with the Holy Trinity, and he's calling us to that. God is calling us. So he will also give us the grace that we need to attain that goal. And you know, one of her most important things was to be grateful. So we do need more gratitude in our daily lives, and just be grateful to God for all he's given us.
Yeah, indeed. Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread. That's what we're supposed to be thankful for. Indeed. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly Blog Talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been talking here with Catholic author Lorraine Bennett. who's has an upcoming book out from Sophia Institute Press called The Little Way of Living with Less, Learning to Let Go with the Little Flower, which has important lessons on dealing with the material world and its various issues and problems, inspired by the French Catholic saint Therese of Lisieux. Well, Lorraine, thank you for joining us on the show.
Gosh, thank you so much, Andrew, for having me on your show. It's been a great delight talking with you today.
All right, then, and for our listeners out there, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.